Hello, welcome to Roots Runners Rhizomes, Radical Health and Healing from the Underground. I'm Sarah Faulkner.
And I'm Lauren Jambroni.
Hey, everybody. So today we're here in the studio with Hudson area psychiatrist Lydia Fazio. We're going to be talking with her today. But first, we wanted to tell you about a local event with Nancy Rosenzweig, who we had on the show a couple months ago.
Last month?
Or a month before.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lauren, do you have the details on that?
Yeah, so Nancy Rosenzweig, she is a certified midwife and OBGYN who we talked with last month. She is doing the monthly healthcare women's healthcare forums. And this month, it's obviously open to all folks. It's this Sunday, May 3rd at TSL from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Nancy is showing the movie Microbirth, which discusses the impact of C-sections on the future health of infants regarding the seeding of healthy bacteria. Shauna Good, who is a nutrition expert, will be showing the film with Nancy. So again, this Sunday, May 3rd at TSL from 11 to 1 p.m.
And TSL is on
Columbia and between 4th and 5th, 3rd and 4th, 3rd and 5th.
And we'll post the details on the Roots Runners Rhizomes page. And another shout out, some of you may remember we've spoken before about disaster relief and empire and capitalism. And so maybe some of you folks who are watching the news and knowing about the Nepal earthquake, anyway, you may also know that I myself have personal ties there. So on the Hudson Wellness Collective Facebook page, I'll be posting some relief efforts if you do choose to donate to that I can personally vouch for having great personal integrity and cash donations will be used with compassion and efficacy. So check out the Hudson Wellness Collective Facebook page. So now we can focus on Lydia Fazio. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for being here.
Hello.
Great.
Lydia, tell us a little bit about yourself to begin. How you've moved to the area pretty recently, right?
Yes, I moved here from down south, as I like to say, from Manhattan. I moved here to to really experience more authentic self, or try to find that, essentially. And I had been living in Manhattan and various other parts of the Northeast for many years, and decided that I needed a healthy change. And hence, migration to the area.
Awesome. And you are a healthcare practitioner.
I am indeed. I'm a psychiatrist, which sometimes people confuse psychiatry and psychology. And a lot of psychiatrists are trained in psychological methods, therapy. But increasingly, psychiatrists focus a lot on the medications that allegedly help people with mental health problems. And so some psychiatrists practice both therapy and medication management. I was trained in a very, analytic tradition in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But then I opted to focus on more the pharmacology, which is focusing on the way drugs work in the brain. And that was what I did for many years.
How long and when was your training, and how long have you been practicing?
Wow, I'm dating myself now. I started basically the way a psychiatrist is trained is that after 4 years of college, I was in college in Rhode Island. I went to medical school, and that's 4 years where you learn, the basics of the human body, et cetera. And after that, you do what's called an internship year, and I did my internship, which is where you do traditional medical stuff. On the inpatient units, you deal with people with heart issues and things like that. That's about a year. And then for 3 years, that's the typical residency, you spend focusing on people with mental illness. And so the total training with medical school is about 8 years. I chose to continue studying addiction psychiatry, and that was a fellowship for 2 years where I focused. I was at Bellevue, NYU, focusing on people that had co-occurring substance abuse issues combined with some mental health issues.
And do you have, I know this can be a complicated thing to answer, but yeah. Can you say maybe how you came to choose psychiatry or that focus in your practice? What did something in particular Sorry about that phone ringing, folks.
Well, you know, it's always, I think it's a confluence of things. I grew up in the Caribbean, and in the 1970s in the Bahamas, there was a big crack cocaine epidemic. The shipments were coming in from South America. I wanted to be a journalist, actually. I was very young. I was a teenager, and I volunteered for the local newspaper where I was doing... Well, trying to write a story about how young people were getting involved in drugs and how it was destroying their lives. And in the course of that experience, I was invited to attend a substance abuse group. That was my first ever. And there was this very charismatic, at the time, you know, I didn't know what a psychiatrist was, but there was this very charismatic Bahamian man who had this very sort of calming, soothing voice, and I thought, wow, he has mastery of this group of people who are suffering, and I listened to their stories. And then after meeting him, it turns out he was a psychiatrist, and he became my mentor, and I wanted to be just like him when I grew up. Hmm. So I shifted my focus from wanting to be a journalist to wanting to understand why people engage in behavior that could potentially be not in their best interest. And so I wanted to be a neuroscientist to understand how the brain worked. And that's what I thought I was going to do. And then also in my personal life, I have a family member who suffered from addiction. And I think as a kid in the Caribbean, we would always get these phone calls that my family member was in jail in Florida somewhere because he had, you know, used illicit substances or was caught using illicit. So I realized that there was some dynamic going on that I wanted to understand.
Hmm.
So
very interesting.
So from that point where you decided you wanted to pursue this path, you know, through inspiration from your mentor and this previous yeah. experience, what did that look like? Can you describe the journey?
The journey was very fraught, I would say. I did, you know, the 4-year college thing in Rhode Island, and I thought I wanted to, like I said, study the brain and be a neuroscientist, and then I realized I was more interested in the humanity, and not only the brain, its structure itself, more the human dimensions of human behavior and why people do what they do, because I also didn't understand why I did what I did. And so I guess I wanted to further understand that, so I decided to go to medical school, which was very difficult for me because part of me did not relate to the way things were being taught. I felt it was a bit rigid and not creative. So I had a hard time actually in medical school, meaning I was always conflicted about whether I should do that or become a sociologist or something different. Mm. So I eventually completed it, you know, 4 long years with a lot of good support from friends. And then I decided to go to a very non-traditional program. I went to Cambridge Hospital, which at the time was one of the few remaining hospitals that taught psychotherapy or psychoanalysis to people with MD degrees. As I mentioned before, typically people who train to be psychiatrists in modern times most often focus on the medication and the medical aspect, but I wanted to go to a place that maybe focused also on the more analytic, more humanistic side of human behavior and integrate that with the science of mind. So that's why I chose Cambridge. So I was trained in an analytic tradition in Boston. And I grew to love it.
Can I ask real quick? Do you mind just describing for us maybe what psychiatry is versus psychotherapy versus I feel a little would like a little brush
sure
up.
So as I mentioned in the beginning that, you know, a lot of people assume that psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers, so there are different professions that address mental well-being or mental health. So for example, the training for a psychiatrist is we are part of the traditionally, we're part of the medical system in that we are trained in understanding the science of how the body works, the science of why, you know, people get sick. And so we go to medical school to, study the workings of the human body. People that do psychology do They end up doing specialized training programs, not in medical schools, although they rotate in medical schools, but they do tend to do a PhD thesis and things like that, which we don't do to get an MD degree after 4 years of medical school. But some, as I mentioned, some psychiatrists do individual therapy, where they sort of talk to you for an hour. But increasingly with managed care pressures, psychiatrists are limited to, I would say, 45 minutes for an intake, meaning when I sit and talk to you about your symptoms, and then I decide on what medicine, if it's indicated for you, and also 15-minute checkup. So we're really reduced to managing the medical aspect of your emotional issues. Whereas the psychologists and social workers, for example, deal more with the managing your emotional dysregulation through talk therapy, and they do not prescribe, although some psychologists in some states, I believe, are able to prescribe. But we prescribe, as psychiatrists, I can prescribe medication, like, say, a cardiologist would, or a heart doctor, or your primary care, but psychologists and social workers do not prescribe medication,
okay,
although we work closely with them.
Okay. Thank you for that.
And can you talk a little bit about how a person who is suffering or struggling might access the care they need, and how it would be determined whether they go to a psychologist or a social worker or a psychiatrist? And I'll say it's been confusing to me as a person with people in my family and friends who have at times been suffering, and they're not. It seems kind of random sometimes how people end up seeing their practitioner. Obviously, if someone's in a very extreme situation and they go to the emergency room, they have a triage, and that seems there's a sort of order of doing things. But can you talk a little bit about how people access your services and other people's services?
So in general, it seems that, at least in my experience, the primary care physician, or the OBGYN, really is probably the first, at least healthcare practitioner in the traditional settings, that can identify that a person may need more a psychiatrist to identify what it is they're struggling with. A lot of primary care physicians and OBGYNs do feel comfortable prescribing some of the more common antidepressants that you may have heard of, like Prozac, Zoloft. So some of these meds have been around a while. So primary care physicians feel comfortable treating what they believe to be depression, and the pharmaceutical industry has done a good job, whether you believe that's a good thing or not, in training people to identify the symptoms of common mental disorders like depression, anxiety, even in some cases bipolar disorder. I should also mention, as a caveat, that I used to work as a researcher in the pharmaceutical industry. So what I sort of didn't tell you as part of the trajectory is that not only was I influenced by, you know, being a clinician for many years, but then I jumped out of the profession to work on a particular drug in Indianapolis with Eli Lilly? Eli Lilly, yeah. I don't know if I could mention names on the air, but yeah, so I worked for them for a few years, and so I saw, you know, how the sausage was made, and that I worked for the pharmaceutical industry, and also at Johnson & Johnson later. And I think that gave me an opportunity to understand how really drugs go from the pharmaceutical industry to the practitioner, like the primary care, and into the hands of someone who's suffering, which was your initial question. But a lot of it has to do with comfort level and, to be honest, marketing. I also, as another disclaimer, I worked in the past for advertising agencies that did healthcare communications for the pharmaceutical industry. So because of my background as a clinician, a psychiatrist, I decided to work in healthcare communication because I felt that I really enjoyed the teaching part, the conveying of knowledge to people, because I firmly believe that if people are suffering, they should be empowered to identify when they individually need, you know, more than what they are trying to do for themselves, and when they should go seek some professional advice. So
you feel there's potential. Sometimes we might see, say, a TV commercial where, you know, a character is presented, and
correct,
someone watching that might self-identify, and they then might be spurred to go to a practitioner.
That is
can that be a good
that
thing?
That could be a positive. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of visceral reactions, and I guess I had also, going back to the conflictual nature of my, you know, relationship to being, you know, a physician versus being a humanist type person, which is that some of the work that the pharmaceutical industry does empower people through those commercials and other brochures and things to identify their conditions, although there is the backlash that sometimes the industry maybe crafts disorders where that are the target for medication, whereas some people are skeptical of whether that condition indeed does exist. So there are two sides to this story, I guess.
And of course, a person might be spurred by a TV commercial to go see the practitioner, and then the practitioner might say, you do fit the criteria diagnostically,
correct,
but maybe I'm going to suggest you exercise or look at your diet instead, right?
That's true. And, you know, to your point about criteria, what clinicians do to identify mental disorders, there is something called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM. We're now at the fifth version, but it's a very controversial document that has laid down the signs and symptoms of mental disorders. And there have been many editorials written about challenging the diagnostic categories that we have come up with. And remember, it comes from World War II, the classification to make sure that soldiers were fit for combat. So that's when it all began.
Oh, is that when it began?
Yeah,
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Oh.
There's a wonderful, summary critique that's been published recently. New Yorker had a series of articles in New York Times. But we use that manual to classify people. And of course, it's very controversial to be able to classify human beings. And that's always been controversial. Now, and I have to tell you, in my evolution as a psychiatrist, and I continue to learn, that my definition of normal has actually expanded, meaning when I first came out of training, I had a very kind of rigid idea of normal, which is like this very restricted bell curve. But as I've met more people, as I've encountered more disciplines, I realize that normal is really is potentially a societal kind of construct. And I think that I am slowly expanding, for example, what I believe to be, you know, true psychosis versus someone's individual belief system. And so I'm becoming actually less certain about certain diagnoses compared to how I felt when I first came out of training. So that's very, I believe that normal is more malleable than I initially thought it to be. And that's how I'm practicing, which is I don't always say you need medication. And that's when I consider other options, and
One of my recent favorite publications dealing with this idea of a malleable normal that's culturally determined is a book called Crazy Like Us. Are you familiar with this?
No.
It came out about 5 years ago, and it's written by, I think, a sociologist or an anthropologist, but it's specifically about how in part because the United States is so good at exporting our culture, whether it's pop culture or, you know, products and things, that some indigenous cultures who may have had useful or even superior methods of working with a person who's suffering what we would call here a mental illness, some of those skills might be lost. For example, some forms of personality disorders or schizophrenia that are characterized by visions might just be integrated culturally as a person who's gifted. And then another resource we've had on the show before, the Icarus Project, which is begun by some folks very nearby in Germantown when he was living here, but of course now is international. And their working mission is to provide a safe network to explore notions of what some might call mental illness being seen, some of it as being seen as, in fact, a gift, particularly for creative folks. So,
well, that's interesting you say that, because it has been my experience. And I've worked in, you know, in settings where people are literally, you know, locked up because they have severe and persistent psychosis or severe mood dysregulation, that there is a way in which the way I'm coming to conceive of it is that they have fewer filters in place to screen out all the inputs, all the inputs around them. And I found them to be quite astute. The problem with having no filters, though, is that you can get very overwhelmed. And in my experience, working with patients that have, for example, what people would classify as schizophrenia, is, you know, they're really attuned to you and how you're feeling on a particular day. I remember walking on the wards and these very chronically ill patients just observing, being able to observe and point out things that would be easily missed by people that weren't so, I guess, that didn't have that experience of psychosis. And it's much the same as people who try, you know, hallucinogens, which, by the way, are making a comeback in psychiatry as treatments for depression. But this idea that, you know, a lot of creative people are people that are very tapped in, have access to things that we normally take for granted and we don't notice. So I've gotten a renewed appreciation for, as you said, the gift of this. But sometimes it tortures people and makes them suffer, which is why, you know, as much as I have this altered notion of what's normal and my threshold for prescribing has increased, that sometimes I do see a value in these drugs, even though they're burdened by side effects, of course.
Right. Can you describe a little more about what your practice looks like these days and what some of the what do you call it?
Modalities?
Yes.
And also, how do you work with a person? Like, how frequently and how many times does a person come to see you? That kind of stuff.
You know, right now I'm working in a very in a traditional sort of outpatient clinic setting in which people are not hospitalized, or maybe they're discharged from the hospital. But I basically see someone for initial evaluation, which, as I mentioned, unfortunately has been stripped down because of the insurance agencies to between 45 minutes or an hour, which is very difficult to sort of come up with an assessment of someone's emotional state and decide whether medication is indicated. But that's traditionally what happens. And then, depending on the severity of the condition or if we try new medication, I tend to see people, you know, 2 weeks after that. If, let's say, I were to start medication X, then I'd follow them after 2 weeks and see how they're doing. And that session, unfortunately, the insurance company limits us to 15 minutes, which, again, is very restrictive. But typically, if a person is stable on a certain medication, you know, once a month, I would see them for 15 minutes or so, which is certainly not enough time. I don't just prescribe medicine. I ensure that someone has other components of their health, because that's my philosophy, is that we focus so much on the symptoms, but we forget that people live in a context. We are human beings that live in a body. We have a certain biology. We live in society. We have relationships. So I try to take what's called a biopsychosocial approach, which is how I was trained, which is you address the biologic issues, you attempt to anyway, because we know biologic issues are affected by psychological issues and the environment through a thing called epigenetics, which is the influence of the environment on our genes or genetic expression. Anyway, then psychologically, I would love for my folks that I see to be engaged in some sort of talk therapy, supportive therapy, whether it's with a social worker or a psychologist or even with an acupuncturist, or to get their diet looked at or to get good exercise. There's a lot of research on exercise and anxiety and depression. In fact, a really good therapy can sometimes take the place of medication. So depending on how severely someone is depressed, I kind of try to make an assessment, and it's kind of a mutual dialogue. It isn't just me dogmatically saying, take this pill. I actually have a dialogue with the person and see what they're comfortable with. More and more people are coming to me saying that I don't want a pill, but are there other things you can give me? And I'm not a nutritionist. And I'm also, I am, though, learning more about supplements, meaning the supplements, which unfortunately are not as often regulated by the FDA, but I often refer to colleagues who are experts in that area if I have someone that is not interested in traditional Western medication, but realizes that they have an issue that needs to be addressed. So I'm developing a network of practitioners of things like nutrition, you know, herbalism, Chinese medicine, massage therapy that I refer people to, and meditation too.
Neat.
Awesome. Some of the integrative modalities, you know, for example, you can sort of look at the person's diagnostic criteria and determine a dosage level for a medication. But do you typically, in terms of exercise or nutrition, sort of how much can you say to a person, and do you refer them to a specialist to get recommendations? I'm asking also because I find in my own practice sometimes when I talk to people and they've had other practitioners recommend exercise, which is a very broad term, you know, and sometimes, for example, if you go to a physical therapist, there are definite sort of containers for expectations. For example, you know, do a set of exercises for half an hour, three times a week for 6 to 8 weeks before you expect to see change or likely change. And then another practitioner might say, well, why don't you try walking? You know, and that's quite a difference. And in terms of what that might mean for the patient, they might experience no effect, or they might experience a huge improvement. So when you're referring to people for other modalities, do you give them recommendations yourself, or?
So it's obviously very tricky to make recommendations when, you know, if I'm not versed in a topic, I'm very open about that. I do know a little bit about different areas, but I'm by no means am I an expert. However, in exercise, it's interesting what I'm actually doing, because I'm also a certified personal trainer through the National Association of Sports Medicine. I am engaging in initial discussions with, I'm into kettlebells myself and bodyweight training. So I'm engaging with two major organizations in those two spheres to design a training program that specifically outlines what exercise, because you're right. When the studies say exercise, they don't often specify what it means. And if you tell someone that is very overweight or obese who needs to take a certain medication to exercise, that's not helpful at all. So I'm trying to sort of use the prescription model to prescribe specific things because of the nature of my qualification, but we don't know what those are. So I'm very careful about giving people recommendations. I try to be as specific as I can, but not when it verges outside of my area of expertise. But I am working on trying to develop a standardized, somewhat tailored kettlebell and bodyweight training regimen for people that are higher functioning and suffering from anxiety and depression. That's going to be in conjunction with whatever I may or may not prescribe. So I'm very, and also it depends on people's cultural background. I'm very sensitive to, not only when I take a history, I don't always say, okay, how many times in the past week have you thought of suicide, or what are your symptoms? I also ask about their context, their cultural heritage, their upbringing, which is difficult to do in, 45 minutes, but I try as best I can to make an assessment. And if I can't do it in 45, I have them actually come back for a part two of the assessment. So it's a very subjective thing, what the person can tolerate. If I have a 75-year-old who's never exercised a day in her life, I think telling her to exercise might not be prudent on the first meeting, but mm-hmm. maybe her mm-hmm. getting to know me. Mm-hmm. There is something called the Therapeutic Alliance, which comes from the psychoanalytic world, but it's about the connection that you have as a healer, at least in the traditional sense, with the healer, with the person seeking the services. There's kind of a bond that you can actually measure. It's almost like chemistry between. So even if I'm just meeting someone for 15 minutes, if I don't have that type of connection, if I give them pill X, they may not take the pill because they probably don't have confidence in it, or they don't like me. I'm not saying that I have that connection with everybody, but that connection is that unseen connection, that trust, because someone is coming to you and they're trusting that you're not going to harm them. I mean, that's prima non nocere, which is the Latin word that we, when we become physicians, we swear to, that I need to get someone's trust before I can recommend anything. And if I don't have it, I'm going to be very ineffectual.
It's great to hear someone who's functioning within the medical world to speak about this, because, you know, we've been taught often to devalue this connection. And in fact, sometimes we see, like, I think it's New York Magazine annually publishes a list of, you know, the best New York doctors.
Sure,
and
yes.
It's so interesting because sometimes my clients will say things like, you know, well, I'm going to the best neurologist, you know, he's a right. real jerk, but he's the best neurologist, you know, and I'm like, well, are you going to get good care if you just told me you think the guy's a jerk?
Right.
And it's very interesting that, you know, sort of in medical terms, we're often taught to just devalue the quality right. of what happens in a personal connection, which is about trust, but also your ability really to take in the care mm-hmm. the person is providing for you, and also for the practitioner to really hear your own narrative and contextualize it properly to actually make good decisions about your care.
I mean, the thing that again, it's a constant learning process, and I'm evolving, I think, as a clinician. I imagine the clinician I will be 5 years from now is absolutely not the clinician I am now. But what I'm really appreciating about human beings and human illness is that there is, each of us has an innate resilience. And some of us are, quote unquote, more resilient than others to different stresses. So, for example, a traumatic experience, the same traumatic experience can have radically different effect on two different people. And I'm beginning to read more literature on optimizing or elevating resilience. So it's a different model from the way I was trained in that, you know, there's illness, I want to squash that illness and, like, be done with it. Like with depression, you know, there's this allegedly abnormal level of serotonin, which is an uber simplistic way of thinking about it. But now there are approaches that are seeking to optimize our innate protective mechanisms and bolster those. That's a very different approach to mental illness than just addressing what's wrong, which is optimizing what is right about the human body. And, you know, in my spare time, I run a group called Biohackers NYC, and we're interviewing all kinds of people that are doing cutting-edge technological stuff to optimize the human person. And then I realized the human body is so amazing, and we haven't really tapped the full potential. And in my practice, I seek to try to optimize someone's innate potential, whatever that is. And I'm not saying I know the secret to doing that, but I'm trying through interacting with different practitioners and reading different literature from different countries to try to understand how people view this issue. How do you live optimally within what you are capable of? Because I believe each of us has an innate optimal level that we can perform at. The question is, how do we get you there? And also, how do we... We are very reactive, at least in healthcare, although that's changing. But I was trained, there's a problem, you address it, as opposed to let's preempt the problem through having healthy eating habits and trying to minimize the inevitable stress and trying to, you know, do certain things. Like, for example, before you get your period, could we be taking supplements? Because I know I get very anemic, so I bolster the iron. But I don't take iron the whole time, just during the period of time where I believe myself to be vulnerable. There may not be a science to that, but it's like this idea of honoring our natural cycles, and we all have them. We all have natural rhythms, and you can't just give someone an antidepressant forever. You know, you have to really honor the body's inherent circadian rhythm.
I want to ask a bunch of questions. I guess first, maybe you mentioned biohackers. Can you just say a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
The Biohackers was an organization that, you know, biohacking is a term co-opted. So the term hacking, you know, obviously is co-opted from the IT world, the world of the computer programmers that used to take computers and make them do things that they didn't typically do on their own, and they would create all these cool programs. But then the molecular biology community sort of took that on and started doing things like trying to figure out, can you make yeast glow in the dark by inserting stuff into their gene? And that was the traditional biohacking, the DIY, do-it-yourself biohacking, you know, do cool things with single-cell organisms. But ultimately, this morphed into something different, which was, how do you make your body perform better than it does at a base level state? And this could be through, you know, taking performance enhancing substances, through meditating or achieving different spiritual levels, through nutritional interventions, and through implanting technology. So there's a whole host of ways in which people are hacking their body, meaning modifying what they are given to achieve some higher state. I took it, my definition is really to invite people that are doing this cutting edge stuff, whether it's the spiritual meditative stuff or the implanting technology like they do at places like Grand House Wetware, but to invite people and have discussions. So I would have panel presentations once a month with really interesting guests that are doing all kinds of things, from developing a wearable neurostimulating device that passes a gentle current through your head, to people that are trying to stave off aging, to people that are doing high-level meditation. So this is my way of doing the stuff that I could never do if I was in a corporate structure. So every month, although it's become less frequent now that I've gotten more busy, but every month in Manhattan it started out, I would do that, invite guests to talk about how they kind of push the boundaries of traditional medicine to achieve optimal human performance.
What would you say, since we were speaking earlier about health and mental health being in context of society and culture, in terms of mainstream culture and sort of how a lot of people live their lives these days, what would you say are the biggest things that people might begin to question and biohack in their lives? Exercise, nutrition, other lifestyle things?
I think what I'm noticing is there's this inordinate emphasis on, you know, collecting data and knowing, you know, all this wearable technology and analyzing and tracking and being in touch and knowing everything. And to me, it's about, and increasingly I've become this way, decluttering, or this idea of simplifying and honoring our inherent nature more. And I'm still trying to figure out a way to sort of get in touch with that. But being, I guess, the slow movement, the slow food movement, the slow design movement is kind of in line with where I'm heading with this, which is just slowing down, not really slowing down, but getting back to a rhythm at which is more innately human. And I, you know, some could argue with me that, look, the pace of life is increasing. Human beings are inherently more dynamic and everything is faster, even biologically. I still question whether things are accelerating at a pace which is not as natural as I believe the inherent rhythm is. So I think, to me, biohacking, initially I was all about, listen, I was all about the technology, all about the substances, meaning all these really interesting chemicals that people are designing to increase your thinking and tinker with your sleep cycle. But now I'm actually going back to basics, which is interesting. It's like I'm going back to the future, which is I'm trying to understand more what our inherent rhythm is. So to me, the challenge of our society, as I see it from mental health, is stripping away all the extra and coming to terms with the innate rhythm that is in uniquely you.
And is that something that you work on or thinking about or talk to your clients with? How does that look, or how does that work out for you?
There is an interesting, I've been starting to use a line from Gordon Starlet, the meditation teacher here. And, you know, he always says, you know, be where you are. And I'm co-opting that from him to really, when clients are coming in all flustered and they say their life is a mess, they can't do this and that, it's almost like first honoring, making them feel okay about where they're at, and then saying, it's almost like pushing reset, because we always struggle so much with where we want to be or where we're not, and it's everything that we're not at the moment. And I think the first step, at least that I'm trying with people, is to identify, one of the questions I ask, for example, is, when is the last time you felt like yourself, right? And so, and a lot of times they tell me, you know, I don't even remember when I last felt like me. And the question is, who is me? And how do I help the person become the me that they inherently are? I mean, it sounds very complicated. And if my medicine takes away from that, then maybe I'm choosing the wrong medicine. So that's something that I'm kind of trying to struggle with. But the step that I'm going through is trying to figure out who this person inherently is with the person. So it's a dyadic communication. It's not just one-sided.
Oh, cool.
And that's the way I try. Mm-hmm. I try to create this as a partnership with the people that I work with. It's an attempt. It doesn't always work.
Sure.
That's really interesting to me, because one criticism I've heard sometimes of sort of both, I guess, biohacking-ish movements as well as maybe modern pharmacology in general, some people's criticism is that a lot of the focus is not on helping people be their best selves, but to be more productive.
Correct.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
That's very interesting.
So, you know, and the reason a person might criticize that idea is that, you know, is there some sort of cultural imposition of, you know, not being the best person you could be with your best inherent gifts shining to the world, but being productive, being a consumer, fitting into capitalism, just being a model citizen, not rocking the boat, whatever that might look like.
Right.
You know, because a lot of things that people have to offer in the world are maybe not honored or valued by mainstream society at large. So then it gets a little tricky when we're trying to feel better. Maybe we're identifying we're suffering or struggling. What part of that is we're suffering or struggling as an individual, and what part of that is we're suffering or struggling as an individual maybe at odds with cultural values? I mean, I guess you could say sort of an extreme example would be, say, you're growing up under Nazi Germany and maybe your society is obviously sick and out of balance. How do you have mental health or health at all living under dictatorship or fascism, right? So I'm not going to draw any parallels between our contemporary political situation with Nazi Germany. That's not why I brought it up, but just as an extreme example of, you know, how does a person maintain or even self-identify what is wellness, what is health in a society that they may or may not have a valid critique of.
Yeah, you know, obviously there's so many points in there, but it made me think of something which I've often thought about, which is we are all forced to do, you know, we have to do something, we have to be efficient. And, you know, my own experience in the corporate structure, because that's how I initially made my living, working in corporate structures, it is the spirit of needing to perform in a specific way, to do. It's about action, and inaction or just not doing is not really tolerated by current structures. And I think the way that influences my practice is that because of my experience, you know, in the doing world and feeling also that pressure to do when it didn't feel quite like me, and that's why I left the full-time, you know, structure that I was in. But it's okay. Part of me is talking to my clients, it's okay sometimes not to do anything, but just to be where they are at. I mean, it sounds very wishy-washy, but that's something that I've started to incorporate more into my practice, and I find that it puts a lot of people more at ease, that they don't have to be anywhere. Like they say, well, when should I feel something, when this drug? And it's like, okay, well, we know scientifically the first 2 weeks, you know, of this treatment, you might feel something. And then within 4 weeks, you know, the interesting thing about psychiatry is that we don't have what's called biomarkers. Like, we don't know if something's going to work, like through a blood test. Whereas, you know, other fields like cancer and heart disease, you know when something's going to work. But sometimes in psychiatry, it's like alchemy. And I still view it as alchemy, even though we have these drugs. But again, it's about honoring the human body. And I think if we try to resist, you know, whatever we do to the human body, it's going to react. So if you apply too much pressure on one neuron, the neuron's going to get accustomed to drug X and stop working. So the body always maintains equilibrium. And I think if we don't respect that, if we don't feel that after a period of intense activity, the body needs to rest, then we're not honoring, again, the way the body was designed. In fact, you know, in a few weeks, I'm going to a psychiatry conference in Toronto, the big meeting. And I like to keep in touch with what, you know, things are going on traditionally in my field, because I don't want to lose sight of the scientific developments that are more traditional. But I want to, you know, also look at the spectrum of what, or, you know, where society is going and the other interventions.
Regarding addiction models, there's been, or addiction treatment models, I should say, you know, there's been, I've seen more discussion lately in kind of the alternative media, so-called alternative media. Now, of course, it's wonderful when a court-ordered addiction treatment model works for someone and everyone's happy. That's great. Sometimes that doesn't happen for people. And then we have sort of the problem of when models of treatment are adopted by institutions that have the power to prescribe them for people, and if they're effective or not effective can really have a serious impact on a person's life. You have experience with addiction and the psychiatry of addiction. Can you talk about maybe some of the exciting and successful models that are out there and maybe some of the problems that are out there, too, that people are experiencing currently?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Again, this is like a constantly evolving. And, you know, at this conference, I'm sure I'll hear more interesting things. But I think if you look at other countries and the way they perceive of, there is the traditional, you know, abstinence view, which is, you know, you can't absolutely use drugs. Once you're sober, you stay sober and that's it. Now, the question is that model right for everyone? And the question is, for whom is it? This goes back to the identifying biomarkers. Who can successfully return to, say, drinking or specific drug use in spurts? So that it doesn't destroy their life or their biology, and who absolutely has to be without the substance. And we know in places like Holland, you know, you can go get, if you're going to use heroin, might as well give you clean needles. And so if you're going to use, might as well use safely. I think that that harm reduction model, I think we are still struggling in our society today to decide which models are we more permissive, or are we more puritanical, are we more punitive? You know, hopefully more and more people recognize that people that struggle with addictive disorders, that it is considered not a moral failing, which it used to be, but more of a part of this spectrum of human suffering and the way people cope. So the model, so I don't have a specific sort of example, but I do have this idea that it is a human mechanism to manage suffering of sorts. And if one honors that, and then one honors the context the person comes from, you can design an intervention which makes sense based on the person in front of you. So I tend not to have a very dogmatic view about, although I did, of course, green out of training, I did everything by the books. So I was like, you can't drink, you need to take this medication to prevent you from having the desire to drink or use cocaine or use heroin. So I would prescribe, you know, you do the anti-appetitive, you do the Campral, you do the Antabuse, you do the Suboxone. I don't know. I think right now I have probably a more flexible approach to that, and I wouldn't. I'm not saying that doesn't work for some people, but I think, again, going back to the bell curve, my bell curve is expanding, and I realize that there is no one answer to the person sitting in front of me, because we are all, you know, inherently unique individuals. Mm. So as far as emerging models, I have to say that I'll have more information about that as I, you know, go to the conference and do more reading. I know that with more work being done on mapping the human brain and understanding the impact of society or epigenetics, which is, again, the impact of the environment on the expression of the proteins from our DNA, that interventions targeting things at a different level might also help. So I don't know if that answers your question. It was very,
yes.
It's a very complex one.
Yes.
I was curious in our last little bit of time together, if you could, I feel like you've been saying this a little bit throughout the course of the show, but maybe just honing in on a few.
Sure.
Here. I have a two-part question. One is, what are some of the things that are inspiring your practice now moving forward, which I feel like you've touched on, but I am curious to hear you say them, like, you know, what are some of the things that are most inspiring to you right now in terms of your work? And the second question is, what are some of the things that you utilize in your life as self-care to support you in doing this work?
Yeah, so the first question is...
Sorry, I wasn't sure if you wanted me to repeat it.
I had the same question written down too, kind of what tools are you most excited about moving forward?
Right.
What areas of focus are you most excited about moving forward with?
So the first one, the inspiration, of course, inspiration for me is it's always unexpected. I think when I moved to Hudson, I started meeting a lot of very, very interesting people, mostly artists. And I think that the whole immersed in this culture of creativity in Hudson, as well as, you know, meeting people, as I mentioned, who are not trained in the traditional medical model. I think, for example, the meditative practice, I was not a meditator. I think that because of my inherent restlessness, I guess I never settled down. But I think the idea, again, of being where you are and being okay with it and not having to do anything sometimes is getting more comfortable with that. And that isn't really inspiring me, that whole idea. Two things. One, of this idea of not necessarily doing in the traditional sense. And number two, the idea of innate, you know, our innate protective mechanisms are the innate potential that we each have, this notion of resilience. Those are the two things that are really driving me at the moment. And unfortunately or unfortunately, I know the military has a lot of money to investigate this. And unfortunately, it is where most of the research, the scientific understanding of resilience, they're studying soldiers that commit suicide and what are the factors that can bolster their... But I have to say that the military, because of its amount of money and access to young people, they are doing a lot of this work, again, whether for good or for forget, as long as civilians benefit. But anyway, so I'm just very interested in resilience. And the tools that I use for my own well-being, and I think this is constantly evolving, I am trying to learn more about my own inherent rhythms and identifying when, for example, certain foods might be best for me at certain periods of time. And I also, I like to exercise, and every time a shift happens in my life, I like to train for some event, and I'm training for this half marathon. So I definitely love to wake up really early and go running. So that's what I tend to do. And then social. I firmly believe in the power of the community and social connections, and so I ensure, no matter how crappy I'm feeling, that I try to connect with friends that fuel me. So it's the nutrition, the body movement, the exercise, and I'm still learning. Sure. I'm still learning, and I don't... and the tools for the people that I work with, as I mentioned, I'm really trying to become familiar with the practitioners in the area so I can make proper referrals. You know, which massage therapist should I send them to? What about meditation teacher? What about herbalist? What about acupuncturist? So those are the things that I'm trying to do. And, of course, I try to stay up to date on the literature. Even though it's traditional literature, I want to make sure that I'm not just have tunnel vision and just treat people one way, because I don't know everything and I will never learn everything. The other thing I do, I have supervision. So I ensure that I have colleagues that are wiser than me, that I sometimes go to with complicated cases, both for the individual connection that I have with patients and to explore that, and also with the medication. So if I have a question, because I don't like to practice alone and I don't know everything, so I make sure that I have that. And that's how I was trained. And I'm also in my own individual therapy to make sure that my stuff doesn't contaminate my sessions. So that's what I do for myself.
Thank you.
Thanks. Back to your the notion of resilience, you brought up something interesting that the military is doing research, which is... you know, and we, as a culture, we've, I suppose, also benefited in the field of plastic surgery and reconstructive surgery from all of our ongoing wars. But it is interesting because the results of studying soldiers and resilience, that would already be sort of a self-selected portion of society, right? A person who would become a soldier is already kind of a niche for want of a better word, I guess, constitution or personality that we might study. What are some other studies of resilience that you know that are going on? I know of, I suppose, Peter Levine's trauma work. He studies after when there's sort of a disaster or an event like a school shooting, and he'll I think do studies with the right. kids who are affected, and you know, the spectrum of effects. Do you know of any other studies of resilience?
The reason that I actually brought this whole thing of resilience, I know that Nature, some of the publications produce this piece on the science of resilience, but there is a talk that I was moved by, actually by a woman, and I forget her name, woman general who used to be in the army. She was a prisoner of war. She was tortured, and then came out and wanted to apply. She's now retired. A really interesting, she was a physician, really interesting woman. And I wish I had the name, but she actually is applying the principles of resilience to civilians. So she wants to give civilians the tools to bolster their innate resilience before they have something traumatic. Because as I mentioned, right, we all know life is traumatic. Bad things will happen. So how do you prepare for them? So instead of just focusing on physical fitness, what she is trying to do is focus on emotional fitness. So each of us, not only, you know, we have all these apps to brain train, but we should really be training our emotional fitness. And how do you do that? You know, she's developing these courses. So to me, her research and her research would be very important. To look at, and I can give it to you, you know, give you her name, if you want to put them in the show notes or something.
And if anyone anyone listening has any questions, of course, you can always contact us. What's our email address?
RootsRunnersRhizomes@gmail.com. And you can find us on Facebook.
And we'll be posting, of course, a link to the show and any other resources that Lydia might think of that she would like to share on the Facebook page, websites and whatnot. So, yeah, we can do that when we remember. Names and other resources. Did you have another question?
Are there ways that people can find you? You're local. Are you seeking new clients or looking to work with new people? Are you interested in opening up the practice to locally, or where are you?
As I mentioned, I'm working in a clinic right now. I have a private practice here, and if people want to find me, I assume I can put, do I say my information?
Or so whatever website, or do you want to say your website?
So I'm in the process of constructing my website, but the way to reach me on website is biohackersnyc.com, and that's a way to reach me. And
you can say phone number.
My phone number is 646-652-9281.
Great. Thank you so much, Lydia. We have about 30 seconds left. I just wanted to say our next show is next month. It's the fourth Monday of every month from 2 to 3 p.m. So that's on May 25th.
And, Nancy Rosenzweig,
Sunday, May 3rd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at TSL. Her health forum is screening a movie called Microbirth, so go check it out.
And we'll post the info also on the Facebook page.
Right. So thank you so much again,
Lydia.
Thank you.